Welcome to the Campus ADR Tech Podcast. My name is Bill Wurz. I'll be your host.
This podcast will be thinking about men who work against violence against women. I have interviews with two men, John Beams and Bob Paskoff, who come from very different backgrounds. John Beams came from a very conservative Republican family and eventually developed a resource center for nonviolence in Fort Wayne, Indiana that has done work on men's violence issues for many years. Meanwhile, Bob Paskoff, as you'll hear, comes from a more leftist background and also developed a very extensive series of programs for men's violence prevention, eventually working in Toronto, although he's from the States. It's interesting to think that the work of men, I guess students of the patriarchy, so to speak, working against violence done by men against women and having it be political work and social organizing. And here are interviews from two men talking about their early development in this area.
And so I'm going to ask John Beams to tell us a little bit about his background and kind of where he works just to help listeners understand his perspective.
Since I'm old, how far back do you want me to go?
Let's go back to 1980.
Okay. In 1980, there was a small group of men that had been meeting together for a few years. We called it a consciousness-raising group. It was a group of men that met once a week or so to talk about our lives, but it was in the context of feminism because many of our partners were feminists, and they were organizing the Rape Crisis Center and the Women's Shelter, and we knew that there was a need for men's voices, and we knew that we were men, but we weren't sure how we fit in. We wanted to feel useful, but didn't want our expressions to be, antithetical to. We wanted to be supportive of the women's work. Now, we just decided to then go public as a group because it had been a very personal kind of a process. We decided to go public as a group. And at first we called it Men Against Violence Against Women, which we thought was a little too gangly. And then, and we saw ourselves as just having kind of a speaker's bureau and supporting the women, because back then the women were really speaking regularly and in a pretty confrontative way about violence against women. And then we got a call from the women's shelter and the prosecutor's office almost simultaneously, independently. They had heard about us, and the guy that was in the prosecutor's office had worked with my partner and others who had been rape crisis volunteer counselors, and he realized that when victims went to court, they were better witnesses if they had had peer counseling from the Rape Crisis Center. So he thought maybe a similar principle would be there if men who were good people were peer counselors for batterers. And this is back in the day when there was no structure for any of that. So we naively said, well, we'll give it a shot, thinking that we'd get one, two, or three guys at a time, take them for a cup of coffee, talk to them, and try to get them to chill out. That was our program. And then we rather soon were confronted with the fact that we were being arrogant in presuming that somehow the men with having a cup of coffee with us would have a truth serum and would be spilling their soul to us while they'd been lying to women for centuries. We got that wisdom when we went to a conference in Pottstown, Pennsylvania called Visions for the Batterers Intervention Movement. And it was Susan Schechter, Ellen Pence, Barbara Hart, and other radical women of the day that had organized a conference. And some of the radical women weren't as skilled at mediation and welcoming and humor as Barbara Hart and Ellen Pence were. So they were mostly just angry, and they were pretty much angry at all men. And so they exhibited that anger in their keynote speeches. And there were a lot of guys at this little conference that just packed up and left. And Barbara Hart got in front of the group and began to ask the audience questions about how they were feeling. And there was a lot of sore feelings and anger and other people thinking about leaving. And so Barbara facilitated a reshaping of the conference so it could be more dialogical. Not forsaking the message that they wanted us to get, but recognizing the humanity of the audience instead of sort of objectifying. And I wasn't one of the people that was planning to leave, but there was something about the magic of Barbara Hart's skill, and then followed by a wonderful presentation by Ellen Pence that used humor and incredible insight and dialogue with the audience that hooked me and made me realize that, yes, we needed to do more than take him in for a cup of coffee.
Hi, Brad.
Hi, Bill.
You're at this conference on battery intervention programs, and you've recently retired.
Yes, I did.
I wonder if you could tell us about some of the work you've done in this field in the past. Just give us a kind of a context of your background.
Well, I don't know quite where to start. I started sort of in the generic men's movement in its earliest days before it split between pro-feminist and kind of whatever else there was. Actually, Herb Goldberg. Herb Goldberg was one of my heroes. Brought him on campus to speak. Loved what he wrote. It was the kind of, oh my God, I can't believe it. Somebody's written about what we're like, you know? That's where it started for me. I mean, it actually started way back, way before that. I have an activist tradition. I come from radical parents and, you know, I was active in the civil rights movement. I was active in the anti-war movement. I was active in SDS. I was arrested 4 times. So all of that's kind of prelude, if you will. But the kind of insight that there's something about being a man that is an oppression, particularly in this culture, that happened with the reading of Goldberg around in the early, I'd say it was in the early 70s, because I had just gotten to Buffalo, 72, 73, okay? And I had been a doctoral student in education trying to write my dissertation and couldn't or didn't or whatever. And at the same time at the University of Buffalo, they had experimental colleges. And I developed an affinity for college, Tolstoy College, which was basically an anarchist college, and went to them with a proposal to begin to teach some courses about masculinity. And they liked it. University of Buffalo, State University of Buffalo, New York. They liked the idea. We were a collective. I joined the collective. I got paid pennies, but, you know, was able to sustain myself and family and develop some courses around the use of fiction and being a man and using fiction as a reflected device. And went to a series of men's conferences. The one that stands out most in my mind was at Penn State University. It must have been 75, 76, something like that. It was very, very intense for me. I think we went there and added a layer to what happened, which was a very personal layer, an affinity group type layer. And I felt really, at that point, called to some kind of what I call men's work. And in one way or another, have sort of been doing it ever since, in men's groups, support groups, teaching groups. I've done some research with another, not an academic, around men whose wives have had mastectomies and how they've adjusted to that. Skipping sort of ahead, in about 1985, I had lost my job at a mental health agency. I tried to organize a union and it didn't work, and was kind of aimless. And my closest friend, who was working in Baltimore at the time, a guy named Andre, who had started the Batterers program at the House of Ruth with a colleague of his. The House of Ruth was one of the first shelters in North America. Aaron Izzy actually had a role in starting that shelter. And Andre is a Buddhist, and was going away to on retreat for, I think, 3 months, and asked, said I was looking for work, would I be interested in the job? You know, and I said, sure. I mean, went down, I interviewed his colleague, Fran, and I hit it off. I moved to Baltimore from Buffalo for 3 months and lived in Andre's house. And then the first night that there was a meeting, it was in an Episcopal church in downtown Baltimore. And at that time, the groups were voluntary. There were no mandated, at least not in Baltimore, any mandated groups. You just men who, for one reason or another, usually because their wives were in shelter or had left them, decided to ask for help. And so it was a small group in the library of a church. And we went in, and Fran introduced me and said I would be working with her, while Andre was away, and maybe we could go around the room and guys could say why they're here as a way of introducing themselves to me. I'm not a religious person, really not. But the only word I know of to identify that experience for me was an epiphany. I heard stories about men and their lives that really resonated with me in terms of my life. And all of a sudden began to be able to define many of the things that I was doing in a relationship as fitting into the paradigm that they were describing. Fortunately, I don't have a history of physical abuse. I'm very pleased at that. Why, I don't know, really. I mean, there's no explanation for that. But I clearly have a history in my marriage, which is over, of a lot of emotional and psychological abuse and the use of a lot of the power and control tactics that we work with. In any case, so by the end of that evening, I mean, I knew that I was home, that I was where I belong. I was doing the work in the most integrated way I'd ever could work, both in terms of working on myself and at the same time working with other people. And I've sort of done it ever since, I guess, until March of this year. I went on to continue at the house roof for a while and then went back to Buffalo as a graduate student in the MSW program and did some field placement and internship in forensic social work. And then shortly after graduation, was hired by the family service agency that I had interned with to start a batterer's program. And I tried to do that, the court-ordered batterer's program. That had become my specialty, was developing court-ordered programs. I began that at the House of Ruth, brought it to Buffalo. As it turned out, Buffalo was not quite ready, and this agency wasn't ready to be able to do that. They wouldn't put enough resources into it. So I did it for, I think, about 6 months, and they laid me off. And I just happened to run into a professor, former professor of mine, who worked for Catholic Charities in their family service program or their family service agency, and mentioned to her what I, you know, what I'd like to do and blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, would you like to come to us and talk to us about this more formally? And I said, sure. And Diane and I and her boss talked, and within about a week, I was hired to start a program at Catholic Charities and did. And developed the model of treatment that is used, I guess, in New York State now, if I understand it right. We developed that program. That's where you and I met eventually. We put forth one of the proposals. There was a call for proposals from the state to set up programs that the state would sanction and use its experiments in the different areas of the state. And we put forth a proposal, a grant, and we were one of the six that was accepted for that. So I did that, I don't know, about 3 years, I think. And then, and in the process, separated and then got a divorce from my wife. I was a very emotionally dependent man on her, as many of the men are that we come across in our work, and really didn't know that I could survive the divorce. I mean, it was a very, very painful and scary experience, even though both of us knew that the marriage was over, that there was nothing to save. The kids were grown, they were out of the house. And although I think we still had, or I have affection for her, it was not a marriage that could last. And so we separated. And I spent about 6 months during that period in a kind of grief haze and doing the work. And finally, and discovered that I could survive. I mean, it was doable. And it wasn't survival on a material plane. I knew how to cook and how to clean. It was a sense of being alone and of not having this woman who I had fallen in love with very early in my life. So then I had a personal coming out party from my depression and from the divorce, and decided I was going to do something I'd never done before. I looked for work in Canada, got hired again at the Catholic Agency. It's really quite amazing to me that, you know, I'm a Jewish atheist communist kid, you know, I mean, so I'm working for the Catholic Church, but I did. And they did well by me, as I think I did by them. And for the next, 13 years, I worked at Catholic Family Services Appeal, again, starting a batterer's program, with the same kind of principles that I had used in the States, and then some of the compromises that the Canadian system demands, which I think are good compromises, which is unfortunate we didn't there wasn't a forum for that at this conference, put in for a government grant, and this what we call the second wave of government grants, and we got it. At the same time, I helped to form a collective because the government, during this period of time, government shifted and then programs got dumped and programs got cut back. And although my program at the agency survived, it shrunk and our salaries got cut. And a group of us decided to start a collective for the Metropolitan Area Action for Toronto that would be able to start working with men. I mean, there were backups in the court. I mean, it wasn't like there weren't customers. There are a lot of men that could be in program, but the system just hadn't gotten around to creating it yet. There hadn't been a really highly developed community response. The women's movement was very suspicious of the men's work, and rightly so in many ways. And there just wasn't that sort of critical energy. And I think we created a lot of that energy, and that collective, which I eventually left, they now are the main program in Toronto. So I feel very pleased with that. And the other piece of work that I've done, which I am trying to suggest to other people that they pick up on, is I went to a local college in downtown Toronto and proposed to them a sequence of courses that would give a person a certificate in working with abusive men. And they agreed to do that. And so I and they set up a certificate program of 3 courses, the third course being a field placement. And one of my ulterior motives was to be able to get some free labor into the program, to be able to get more groups going. A lot of students came work with me. They didn't have to work with me. They could work with any program. I'm proud. I mean, I think a good chunk of the people in the Toronto metropolitan area that do this work are people that I trained to do it. I'm happy about that.
Could I ask you a little bit about your philosophy of change in terms of what is it was men need to do to stop using violence? What's do you have a principle that helps you organize your work?
$4,000 question. I think I do. I think John put it well before that we now have a core of principles that the work informs us, guides us. And I accept those. I believe that this isn't primarily an issue of power and control for men. I believe that all programs need to have the safety of women and children as the highest priority. I believe that an educational model tends to be a better model than a therapy model, although I'm interested now, as I've retired, in moving more into a therapy model for another population to do this work. I think because of economy of scale and things like that, there needs to be, unfortunately, not as long a treatment as would be good, but at least long enough to get the message across. And there needs to be open groups. And there needs to be, in Toronto anyway, where we are really very multicultural city, a lot of different ways to do this work with a lot of different communities. We have a very diverse city. Beyond that, though, I think that, and it's kind of been my commitment to say that it's worked as well as I think it has for John, that this has to be a movement. It can't be a social service program. It can't be a social service agency-driven issue. It needs to be a men's issue, and it needs to be ultimately about changing the nature of human relationships. And that in some sense, men who batter, men who are abusive, are potentially in the front line of that change. I believe this, and I know that's heresy to some people, but they are the men who have the most opportunity at this point to change the world if they can change themselves first. They know this problem better than any 10 social workers do. They can, in fact, I believe human beings can change. I've seen men change. I've seen men who were horrible with their partners at one point become loving and caring and egalitarian and supportive, fied by the experiences of their partners. And that what we're doing is sort of the cutting edge of social change in the modern industrial Western world. Those are
very good. In terms of your impressions of the conference, were there any takeaway things for you, any impressions that you got from watching the sessions? And
The conference for me was different, I think, than it was for a lot of other people. I'm in a transition stage in my life. I've just retired and I'm trying to figure out what to do with the next part of my life. So I came here looking for a message from the universe that I could still do this work and that my thoughts on how to do this work and where to go with this work next made sense, and to find actually the energy here to begin to do that. So I had very personal motives for being here. And I have some answers to that. I want to go home and share it with my partner and kind of let it settle in, because you're high off of most conferences and 2 weeks later, it's like, oh my God, what am I thinking there? So I want to give it the test of time. In terms of the traditions of our work and what I saw at this conference, I was in many ways very pleased with the conference. I agree with John, we've created a bigger tent, I think. Now, we'll find out tomorrow, when we try to form an organization. But at least there were people's voices who do things somewhat differently than the dominant way of doing things that weren't challenged, put down, shamed, driven out of the tent, so to speak, or the hall. And that's a good thing. That's a very important phenomena in this work. I haven't seen it yet in Canada. The U.S. is probably further along than Canada is in many ways. If that's a genuine change from where things have been 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I think we're doing very, very well. I think some of the shortcomings of the conference was the multicultural issue, which should have been at the top of the agenda and apparently was sort of nudged onto the agenda at the later on in the planning and didn't get enough time. I mean, I think that's a major issue that we need to deal with. So that was a sort of a weakness. Another weakness, and I don't want to, I guess this is broadcasting, but the conference was not sensitive to the needs of the participants at the conference. It was too much. I understand people's exuberance, and let's do as much as we can in as short a period of time as we can. But by that workshop this afternoon, people were dragging, And it's just, you can't, if you're going to do this work, you have to be able to pace yourself in a way that allows you to take care of yourself. And we weren't allowed to take care of ourselves at this conference.
You mean the Funk Brothers wasn't enough?
Wasn't enough. It was the beginning, but it wasn't enough. And the final criticism that I had, which is important to me, I think there's a kind of America-centric, if I can, attitude at this conference, that there were, I gather, a dozen countries here. No other country had any representation on any of the workshops or planning or models presented. I know the work that we've done in Canada, and there were some very important people here from Canada who do very good work, didn't get put on the agenda. And I would hope that the next time there's a conference like this, it will broaden even more to include the models of treatment and work that are being done in other countries.
Hey, thank you very much. Well, that does it for this evening's recording. I have to apologize for the audio quality. I used about 3 different mics and was having a good deal of difficulty with my laptop on the road. So I ended up actually recording most of this on my Life Drive using the built-in voice memo. So the quality leaves something to be desired, but I think the content is good. Thanks again for listening to the Campus ADR Tech Podcast. You can check the show notes for more information. This is Bill Warders, signing off.